Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We bring you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true with those new paradigms, looking for those new ways of living and many different ways of doing that. And today's program is no different than any other. It's going to be very exciting. And we have studio guests this time in our midst. And we want to let you know that the program comes your way Mondays at 1 a.m., Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m. The podcasts are available on the radio show's page at richarddugan.com, and we are also streaming live. When the broadcast airs on the radio, you can hear it there, or you can go to the radio show's page and listen to the audio file. And remember, these programs are not necessarily only the length of the radio broadcast, which is 50 minutes. That's what we've been allocated. The interview could go on for an hour or two or three. You don't know unless you go to the website and you listen to the interview. We are very excited to continue a conversation that we have been having for, 10 years or more about sound. I brought up the subject some years ago about the Mozart effect. And I met this gal through a mutual program that I produce and I'm a part of. And Willa Weber is in studio with us. She's... I want to say all the way from Germany. Your arms must be tired. Ha, ha, ha. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me here, Richard.
And we also have a composer who is going to join the conversation you brought with you, Marcello De Francisi.
Exactly, yes.
And I thank you so much. You're from where originally?
I'm of Argentinian descent.
Okay.
Italian-Argentinian descent.
From the south.
Yeah.
I mean, really, from way down south.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're gonna play some of your music, especially a piece that that you felt would really be appropriate for the program, and I'm looking forward to featuring that at the end of this particular segment. So I'm really excited about it for all of us to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Your website. Tell us about your website and what's available. I want to kind of get the preliminaries out of the way before we dive into this whole aspect.
Yes, people can definitely check me out on my website, www.willaweber.com. And Willa is with 2 L and Weber with 2 B. And you can see a lot of videos of different live shows I've done in Europe. And you can listen to music. You will find your way through.
And do you have a website?
Yes, of course.
And
it's MarcelloDeFrancisi.com.
Okay. We're going to be linked to both of you, okay?
Great, wonderful.
We'll have a link that people can go to try to spell them both out over and over and over again. Gets a little redundant. So go to the richarddugan.com website, if I can say it, and click on the links to this program. 2018 is what we're kind of into right now, and one of the things that has always fascinated me, and I mentioned the Mozart effect, which I'm assuming you're familiar with the theories and so forth behind that, either of you?
There's a lot of theories behind Mozart. So
exactly. I remember reading about a study that was done where they wanted to see what effect Mozart's music had on people. And I first thought was, why Mozart? Why not Bach, Beethoven, Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, etc. on infinitum?
Sure.
On some of the other composers, because they got some great classical music too.
Uh-huh.
I was never a classical fan. My first introduction was in grade school, when our music class, our singing class, it was music memory is what they called it, and you had to memorize a piece of music and match it with the composer. And if you passed the final exam during the semester, I was born and raised in Phoenix, so you got to go to Tempe, to Arizona State University, to Grady Gamage Auditorium, and listen to the Phoenix Symphony Orchestra play those pieces that we were learning from the various composers. And I got it right, so I got to go, and it was very cool. So that was my first real introduction to classical music. And then when I started working in radio, I was working the night shift, and I would come home, and I became a member, and I can't remember why. I joined a classical music CD club, and I just started ordering, and whatever they had that month, I bought.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a very diverse collection of classical music. I'm no longer a member, otherwise I'd have a room full. But I loved listening to it. It was something so soothing. It almost didn't make any difference what it was. I mean, Brahms, obviously, I think, every time I think of Brahms, I think of course, the lullaby, Brahms' lullaby. But each composer had a particular style. But Mozart, they chose to run these tests. As a composer, when you're creating a piece of music, are you, is it just flowing out of you, sort of like channeling it down onto the paper, or do you already have an idea of the kind of, shall we say, emotions that you want to elicit in the listener, even if it is for, say, a movie or a TV show or whatever it is that it's going to be incorporated into?
Well, yeah, I mean, I take my work very much like work. It's not something that this whole idea that somebody sits down and gets this idea and puts it down, it does happen, but you know, when you do this for a living and you're working every day in the studio and you're composing and you have a deadline, you kind of become you discipline yourself to sit there and to make the inspiration come to you. In other words, it's when that happens, of course, you know, you delve into your own personal emotional realm to bring out in the work whatever it is that you're trying to interpret. I always say that the greatest artists of our time are great psychologists.
Okay.
You know, they know humanity. They know when a person is sad, when they understand the human condition really well. And in order to be able to have that discipline where you're saying, okay, I want to be able to portray, you know, sadness or happiness or whatever it is, the mood that you're trying to portray through music, you have to really understand the human condition so that you can, so that it flows through your hands into the keyboard, yeah, or whatever instrument that you're using.
Give me a little rundown, if you can, of where people might have heard some of your music, because you're all over the place.
Well, I I'm a film composer. I've done multiple films. I did a film actually that was first shown here at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, a movie called Samsara, mm-hmm, which had a worldwide exposure. I did a film with Natalie Portman and Ian McGregor it was called Jane Got a Gun. It's a movie that
I think I've seen that one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've worked a lot with a singer that actually is a singer from Dead Can Dance. Her name's Lisa Gerard, and she's done a lot of albums, a lot of films. We have co-wrote a lot of scores together. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of music for all kinds of venues. A lot of my music has been used in trailer advertising. I've worked in television, so my work is all over the place.
And when you say trailer advertising, that doesn't necessarily mean that if it was a trailer for a movie, that music is necessarily used in the movie. It was just specifically for that trailer.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, people involved, and I gotta go see this.
Well, today the trailer industry, the music for trailers has exploded exponentially, and so I've had my music. Tracks that I've actually written specifically with trailers in mind been used on Avatar, on Exodus, mm-hmm, on, you know, National Treasure. It
actually in the movies.
No, in the trailers.
Just the trailers.
Just the trailers.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what
I thought, yeah.
Yeah.
What about video games? Especially online gaming. I mean, I've heard that just exploded a few years ago, both with not just in terms of just music, but even vocals.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, of course, they're always looking for voiceover, you know, voiceover talent as well to put the voices in as you're going through the game and you hear people in the game talking, not just the participants who are playing the game.
Yeah, well, I actually worked on the first series of the God of War from Sony, SCA, God of War, and the whole team who worked on that and on the soundtrack, and we won a Gang Award, which is like the Academy Award for Best Soundtrack for games.
Yeah.
It's Gang, G-A-N-G. I think it's Game Audio Guild Award.
Oh, wow.
You know, so yeah, that was something that I worked on. So.
Yeah. Now, Willa, how is your music categorized? For people who are looking for it, say, mm-hmm, online, mm-hmm, Willa Weber, mm-hmm, what are they going to find? What's the style? I know that there are a lot of artists, there are bands and single artists, they don't like to have their music pigeonholed.
Yeah.
But if people are looking for the type of music that you do, I've listened to it. I love, mm-hmm, listening to the, mm-hmm, to the sounds that emanate from you and the music that accompanies you as well. But how would people recognize you as far as a genre?
As a category, I think world music would be probably the thing. You can't deny my classical background. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is obviously in my voice, but the kind of music I just produced with Martin Davich, this EP, it's you know, people put it in the category world music.
Right.
Or classical crossover, you know, could be also.
Would you cross over to opera? Operatic, maybe?
Well, that's the thing. Here in the States, people right away say opera singer once you have a classical voice. Yeah, you can say opera, crossover. Sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And how long have you been singing?
Well, I mean, my whole life, you know. Okay, so it always played a big role. I studied it. Of course, I studied the full program. I studied also even conducting and music theory and piano. And singing was always the thing to do. Actually, I love to perform live. When you talk about sound and effect of sounds, I really love and I feel like sometimes very grateful and humbled also when I get on stage and I sense the energy in the room, the people, and you can sense a lot when you are up there, and how during the concert this whole energy changes. Sometimes, of course, visually, because people emanate much more happiness or, you know. So
There's an atmosphere about going out to listen. I know that when I go to, for example, the venue here in Santa Barbara, that it's probably set up better than any other place for listening is the Granada Theater. I had the great pleasure of interviewing the acoustician of the Granada Theater. Because when I had gone in there, before I had the interview with him, I'd go in there and I was looking at all of the tiles. Marcello, have you been into the Granada?
Is it the movie theater that has kind of like a, it looks like it's got buildings on the side? Is that the?
It's just over here, two blocks to our west, and maybe a few doors down. I'm not sure. There are buildings to either side of it, and it's like the tallest.
I was in a movie theater that had like a facade of buildings on the side, inside it, inside the building itself.
That might have been the Arlington.
Okay, I think that's the one.
It was all white, almost Spanish style.
Yeah, that's the one.
Well, this one, you have all of these square tiles all over the walls. And of course, I'm the type of person, whether I'm listening to a piece of music or whether I'm looking at things, I'm always looking for patterns. And I was staring at this wall and I'm looking for some kind of a pattern. I'm trying to, you know, put it together. Mm-hmm. So when I went to interview the acoustician, he says, "You won't find one." He says, "Every single tile is different because they measure the sound in each of those spots where those tiles are, and they design a specific tile for that specific spot. Even on opposite sides of the room, exact same positions, they're different." Wow. So you won't find it. And that's why there's no bad seat in the house. No matter where you sit, in the balcony, in the front row, or somewhere in the middle, you're going to have awesome sound. Now, Gamage is somewhat similar in that the balcony is not attached to the wall in the back. It's actually suspended. And so the sound actually goes around the balcony. And this is what I had heard. And I've been up there in the balcony, and I've looked back in the back there, and I'm going, "What's holding this thing up?" But it's remarkable the level of sophistication that has gone into many venues as far as the acoustics. I mean, if you go into some of the larger old churches, especially the Roman Catholic churches, or even the churches in Europe, the sound is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's.
I remember when I first walked into Notre Dame, I was traveling through France. I had to go to another country, and I'll never forget this moment. I walked into Notre Dame, and there just so happened to be a Gregorian choir singing. And just the reverb when I walked in there is something that just has haunted me as a, you know, somebody who works in this field. And I'm also an engineer, so I score engineer all my films. So that sound just, you know, when you listen to something like that, it's hard. You know, sometimes you get a program and they say that they've emulated or they've sampled it, but it's inexplicable when you know. Or when you're in the city of Seville, you know, and I lived in Seville. I studied fine arts there. In the cathedral, La Giralda, has an extraordinary reverb. Extraordinary.
Incredible. Willa?
Yeah, you know, I come from this part in Germany, South Germany, where we have these really huge, huge Baroque churches. And this is actually where I grew up as a singer, where I had my first experiences as soloist. And actually, I have to say, with all what I do with recording here in LA and working with different composers, when I come back and I get this, you know, I get asked to do a concert like in churches like this. This is the most exciting thing for me still to do because, you know, there are these churches who stand up very high where the organ is. You almost feel as if you are in heaven. I mean, it's so beautiful. And you sing with no mic and your voice just fills the whole room, you know. So this is something what I come back a lot, that these are my roots, you know.
Yeah. I grew up in a Roman Catholic church, and the church that I attended in Phoenix was called St. Agnes, and it was it had a very high ceiling. I mean, it was big. And so I want to say St. Peter's in New York. I think we went in the front door and got to look around a little bit, and that was about it. And I was in a few smaller churches in Ireland that don't quite have that same reverb that you're talking about. But St. Agnes had it to some degree because it was a very large...
Like St. Patrick's in New York.
St. Patrick's, not St. Peter's is in Rome.
Yeah.
In the Vatican.
You know, the interesting thing that I found when I was in these churches, you know, both in Seville and in Paris, was I would listen to the shuffling. You know, like people are, you know, praying, they get up and you hear, you know, they're putting down that thing that they put on they're kneeling.
Yeah.
And you'd hear the shuffling of the wood and it would just create this sound, this cacophony of sound of people whispering, and you'd hear in the end somebody singing Gregorian you'd hear the shuffling, and it's just, it was like being in a separate reality of some sort, you know. You're taken right into a different world, you know. It's extraordinary.
I'm curious, when you are composing, you know, it sounds, from my understanding, you sort of have an intent already in play. But at the same time, are you also thinking about maybe some of these places where we might be able to perform this and get the kind of sound that we want? Because we're not going to get it in studio unless we do something electronic to it, add an effect to the tracks.
Well, that's one of the reasons.
Quite the same.
Well, no, I mean, in today's day and age, you know, technology has allowed people to really be able to reproduce just about any sound in a studio. And that's one of the reasons I've pursued engineering in full depth, apart from composing, because today, you know, I mean, when people were composing back in the time of Beethoven, they were hearing the elements of that time. Today, you know, music has a lot of sound elements, a lot of sound design, because we're exposed to so much sound today. And so, you know, I took it upon myself to really study that aspect of the work so that I would have a much greater palette. You know, so if, you know, as opposed to just being a composer that just hires an orchestra, I do hire orchestras, but I also use the palette that's available to me through modern technology as well, which is quite immense. You know?
Yeah. When I'm producing commercials or even programs with people who are using music within the context of their programs, I use a multi-track editor. I have an effects bay that I've set up for the voice track. I never do that to the music track. Because that music was produced in such a way created by the composer and so forth. I don't want to mess with that. I want to maintain that. When I used to transfer these big 10-inch reel-to-reels of symphony music, a friend of mine who was a percussionist under the conductor Abravanel in Utah, he brought these reels to me and said, hey, let's transfer these to the computer and so forth. I never messed with the volume, because the intent when it was performed, let alone when it was composed, was you want this part low and then you want this other part loud. And I know that's crescendo, decrescendo, and so forth. Some of the terms I remember from grade school and high school singing. I never wanted to mess with that because I thought, you know, this music, even if it was just library production music, you know, I could do all kinds of, and I'll do looping. You know, and I'll do those kinds of things, but I don't want to change I'll call it the context of the music.
Sure. You know what happens is I'm listening to you speak right now, right? And a composer will actually, like in my case, I'll tell a story through music.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so if I were to record what you just said right now, and I listen to all the different volume and all the accents and the emphasis that you've given on the words that you've just spoken, music is the same way.
Yeah.
You're telling a story. It's a dialogue
yeah.
that has to be said strong at a certain moment. Then it has to come down. It has to be soft. There's moments of silence that actually are creating, are saying something within that music. And so composers... You know, it's, you know, composers are actually, you know, creating a dialogue through instruments. That's why the music has yeah. that, you know.
You know, I just thought of something else, another exposure to classical music that I didn't even think about until some years later, and then it just came back to mind now. Another place I never would have thought, and I don't think we as kids grasped it at the time, was the classical music and operatic inserts into the Warner Brothers cartoons
oh,
of
yeah.
Bugs Bunny and mm-hmm. the Roadrunner and so forth. They were using classical music. And it was only years later that I understood that that's what they were. I still remember one cartoon where they had this one guy singing opera. He was singing a legitimate real opera,
mm-hmm.
but they were playing with it, of course. And of course, Bugs was the conductor, and apparently he and the male singer did not like each other. So,
wasn't Fantasia, the movie Fantasia, also from Disney? They used Tchaikovsky.
Yes,
in there. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Remember, yeah.
And it's like, it's incredible that these adults who created these incredible works, the cartoons, I mean,
mm-hmm.
like Disney and Warner Brothers, incorporated that in for children. To be exposed to that. What other way is a kid going to be exposed to this? And then I start hearing interviews of rock bands, even heavy metal, okay, thrasher bands and so on and so forth. What was the impetus? What really got you started? Well, one of my was classical music. And of course, a lot of people too, it's church music, which is, there's certain elements of classical music within, depending upon the church you grew up in.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating. That, and again, not having even realized it at the time until years later, of the influence of classical music.
Yeah.
There's just something about it. Now, is that predominantly the type of music that you compose, or do you cross many different genres?
I cross many different genres, but I, you know, some of the pieces that I've done for a couple of films, and mostly the work that I've done for trailers, has been very much influenced by choral music, you know, where I've taken an orchestra, recorded with orchestra, recorded just about everything, put in the kitchen sink,
yeah.
and put in choirs, written things in Latin, and you know, the trailer that was used for Avatar is a piece that I wrote all the choirs in Latin, and it's, you know, and I was very influenced by the work of actually the Requiem by Mozart. I love the first mm-hmm. nine pieces of the Requiem by Mozart. Really mm-hmm. has impacted me till this day.
Yeah.
That I listen to it.
I probably heard it. I'm not recalling it off the hand, but I probably heard it more than I can remember. There was a piece. I think it was Pavarotti, the opera singer Pavarotti, that they used in a very dramatic scene near the end of the movie Sum of All Fears.
Okay.
And then I remember,
wasn't
too,
that Richard Gere?
Morgan Freeman was in Sum of All Fears.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
And
okay, sorry, yeah.
I want to say Ben Affleck.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, you know, I'm watching the film and I'm listening to the dialogue and the sound that's going on, and then all of a sudden this comes up and I'm seeing all of these different events happening
mm-hmm.
Underneath this piece of music. This
sure.
this incredible. I have to say that my wife and I am so glad we did it. We actually went and saw Pavarotti sing when he was in Phoenix back in 2000. Was it 2001 or 2 or 3 or something? This, of course, a few years before his passing.
Mm-hmm.
It was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
A woman that we saw sing in Phoenix as well, Sarah Brightman.
Oh, I love Sarah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Not just the theatrics, but the voice,
yeah.
you know, and then when I hit someone like that, I start collecting everything I can find.
Sure.
It's always what's bothered me about the music industry in particular, especially the pop music industry. As I was growing up, I'd hear a song by an artist, and that's the only song you heard every 10 minutes or what have you, right? It's like, well, wait a minute. What else have they done? What I want to hear more than just this song. And unfortunately, that's still the case even today in radio, and they're starting to have a certain level of influence as far as releases on the internet. But that's what I love about a lot of the independents. They're saying, forget the record deals. I'm going to release my album, my pieces, all of them, to the public and make them available.
Sure.
I mean, you know.
But I mean, you know, the radio stations have been a great avenue of exposing. I mean, through radio stations, when I was younger, I was exposed to artists, and then I would buy the album, and then I would discover these jewels that you would go, no one's ever played this on the radio, but this is a jewel. And, and I kind of like that in a way. It's you know, you mentioned Sarah Brightman. Willa's manager actually has worked with Sarah Brightman.
Really?
So, yeah.
I'm also curious about a lot of the duets that come about. One in particular I think of is it wasn't Pavarotti. I can't remember.
Domingo Carreras?
Well, he did a duet with John Denver.
You mean the prayer, like Bocelli, who sings with a lot of different...
Bocelli? Andrea Bocelli?
You're talking about?
Oh.
He laughed.
Incredible.
Yeah. I just sang this duet in a concert here with a cantor in the synagogue. It's a very famous song, The Prayer, right? You're talking about that. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, just... I had a chance to interview my parents a year or two ago on this program, and we talked about music and how important is it to them? Was it to them as we were growing up? And is it today? And they... Absolutely essential. I mean, and they feel very strongly, and that there are a lot of folks who, I've got no favorites. I don't listen to anything, and it's like, wow.
I know people that just don't listen to music, but
but
that, you know, it's like everything else. It's they haven't had the exposure. You know? Once they get the exposure, people start to need it. It's.
And I remember as a kid growing up, I heard my elders making the comments about the music of that day. You know. You know, that music is terrible stuff, you know. And I swore I was never, ever going to listen to any kind of music and make that kind of a statement. Because the individual who created that piece, it came from somewhere. They're trying to express something. They're trying to say something. It's like you say, when you compose, you're trying to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And even if it's in 3 minutes, or if it's a piece that's 30 minutes or 3 hours long,
the one thing I do notice is that as you get older in life, you know, the things that are actually truth, eventually you learn to accept them. For example, when I was younger, I struggled listening to classical music. I bought Bach, and I bought, you know, and the one music that really inspired me a lot was an album my parents gave me, which is Arthur Rubinstein's Moonlight Sonata. It was an album of all the sonatas that Beethoven had done. But I struggled with classical music. As I got older, I was able to appreciate them. I had the same experience with wine, for example. When I was a kid, you know, growing up in an Italian-Argentinian family, wine was, you know, abundant.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand it. And as I got older, I got to appreciate it. And I think classical music is the same thing. Yes. Some people have that maturity when they're young where they naturally accept it. But it took me a while to understand it and to be able to appreciate it, you know. Mm-hmm. But in the end... I think truth in many forms of art, you know, eventually, you know, you learn to grow with them. I had the same experience with the Guernica by Picasso. I used to look at this poster all over Spain. I lived in Spain. And I would see this poster and I would say, what do people see in this Guernica? I mean, I don't get it. And one day I went to the Prado when they actually were able to acquire the painting. They had this building outside the Prado, which is just designed for the Guernica. And I walked into this room and I looked at the Guernica and I was stunned. Sat there for an hour just looking at this painting. And understand and realizing why you see this postcard all over the world of the Guernica, you know. But it took time for me to get to that level of appreciate to be able to appreciate it. It's timing, you know.
Willa, What about your influences as you were growing up?
Yes.
And dovetailing off of what Marcello has been
absolutely.
Saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in my case, I was totally sunk into this tradition of classical music, you know, choir, Handel, Bach, and especially when you grow up Catholic, you know, there are all these festivities, Eastern and Christmas, and they do the oratorios. So I was like swamped. Is that the right word in English?
That's not bad.
Yes. So I was like totally in this pond, you know. So, and you
submerged.
Take it submerged, you know.
Thrown into the deep end.
Yeah, and it almost felt like revolutionary. It's really will crack up if I would listen to some other pop music, you know, in this, because I was totally into that, and I took it so for granted. And this is the thing in life, like what Marcello just said, like then staying away longer, also from your homeland and everything, and you know, and as you grow older, you really sense the value in all this. Even now, when I go to the studio and work and they want me to sing a certain way, I see, oh wow, I'm grateful, I appreciate this kind of background I have, you know, from the classical side, you know.
Now, okay, I want to touch on that. When they want you to sing in a particular way, define that a little bit more.
Well, if sometimes, you know, it's a process of writing. So if a producer wants me to sing a melody he wrote, you know, in a certain way, I just have this capacity to be at home, go to the piano, learn it myself, and deliver it, you know. You see.
And doing that, emotion is a huge part of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you speak a number of different languages.
I sing in at
you
least.
Sing.
I sing in 10 different languages, but I speak only 3 languages.
Only okay.
So it's not. I mean, I would be. That would be.
Now, when you say you sing in 10 different languages,
yes,
that doesn't necessarily mean that you understand.
Of course, I understand exactly what I sing.
Okay.
I mean, I have to.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to turn down when I in my early days back in Phoenix when I was living there. There were people that wanted to come and they wanted to a simple little microphone setup, you know, to record with guitars or tambourines or things like this, and they wanted to do it in Spanish. I said, well, the only problem is I don't know what you're saying, so I'm not going to know if you make a mistake or not. And it's the same thing with say commercials. I can't record a Spanish spoken commercial. Because I don't know if you made a mistake. You're going to have a translator here to make sure that everything is the way that it is. Because when it goes on the air, that's the way it's going to be. And so that's when I think about musicians who can sing in different languages, such as yourself. So when they want you to sing in a particular way, it's not necessarily having to do with necessarily the syncopation per se versus volume, crescendo, decrescendo, that kind of stuff. But emotion. If you understand what you're saying, then you can tap into the emotion of the lyricist or the writer, the composer of that piece.
Actually, I had the experience, especially in my years when I was in New York. For Americans, it's always very exciting if they hear different languages. And I created what I still call the Global Acoustic Project. So I had regularly performances in the Gershwin Hotel, in the Andy Warhol scene there. Mm-hmm. And I had different musicians on stage from different cultures. And I sang these different songs from Hebrew over Czech to some Russian song. And people really, really liked this. And I experienced it myself. Look, music is the language of the heart. Even if the audience sitting there don't really understand the lyrics, they understand it from their heart, you know. And this is where I feel we artists can, in our own little way, in a way, contribute to the understanding of different cultures, because we all long for the same. You know, we all have this longing for peace and love. I mean, this is now, you know, these are simple keywords, but that's basically in all these different languages and in all these songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what in this last concert in the synagogue on this EP I recorded with Martin Davich, it's a song in Arabic. It's from a very old Persian poet. I used some lyrics. And then I sang, I have another piece which is Aramaic, and that's the language that actually Jesus taught. That was the language before Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And I later found out that both texts have the same message. So you have the Persian Arabic on this side, and you have the Aramaic Hebrew. And this, you know, and this is so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a language of the heart. you know.
Can you tell me about, because we're about ready to go to break here, tell me a little bit, both of you, about this piece that we are going to listen to, okay, as we go into break. What this is that EP that you were talking about, Willa?
This piece is already out and okay. Finished. No, we're so talking about the piece that Marcello De Francisci produced with me, which was a real wonderful experience and a trip, a real good trip, you know. The title of it is Tolerance.
I met Will. I really liked her. I saw her perform, and I really liked her work. And I wanted to. I saw that she was very versatile in her talent, where she was able to address many different cultures. And my approach to working with Willa was to find, you know, not the international side of Willa, but her own unique voice, you know, without language, you know, who is Willa as an artist. And so I. You know, listening to her music and knowing her background, having lived in Germany and having had a classical background, I thought that it would be great to address what I feel is a real strong side of Willa, which is to address the classical side yet making it contemporary.
Okay.
You know, and using a lot of techniques on a production end to bring her voice to sound really lush and beautiful and haunting.
So. More so than it already does.
More so than it already does. Yes, sir. Yes.
Wonderful. Absolutely. Tolerance will be the piece we're going to go out with here on the program. I'm Richard Dugan. We're in studio with Willa Weber and also with Marcello De Francisci. I'm Richard Dugan. We're in studio with Willa Weber and also with Marcello De Francisi. And we've talked about on this program, we've talked an awful lot, and I'll have you dive into this too, Marcello, the aspect of language, what little I know of, the Hebrew language. I've done a little study about it. I can't speak it, write it, or understand it, but I do know that 22 letters in the alphabet, each of those letters has its own legend. It has a numerical rating. It has a vibrational tone. It has, in essence, its own story. When you start putting those letters together into words, you create a new story, and it maintains all of the other elements of the individual legend. Words into sentences, again, a new level. Sentences into paragraphs, into chapters, into a book, a whole new arena, if you will. You translate that from the Hebrew into especially English, that legend, that story is washed away. It's gone. You don't have the real, I want to say meat, if you will, the essence of what was originally written in that language. The English language just doesn't have that. Each of the 26 letters in the alphabet, as far as I know, and I've taken English classes and so forth, I don't know that A has a vibrational tone. I know it's number one in the alphabet, and Z is 26. I see letters and numbers in colors. Okay. Mm-hmm. I believe they call that kinesthetics, I think, yes, is what the name is. Uh-huh. And I've said, for years, I mean, it was, since I was a little kid, when I start thinking about the days of the week and the months of the year and the years and the century and so forth, I see the hues as they change from one month to the next because of the combination of the colors in that particular word, like the word January or the word February and so on and so forth. But that's always, that's just the way it is. So if I was to translate that into something else, I might lose those those aspects. Mm-hmm. What about that in terms of, especially for you, Willa, in terms of, say, singing the same song, but in several different languages, because you understand the original language it was maybe written in, as you say, either Hebrew or Aramaic or Arabic and Persian and so forth, you already have that. So you can translate that, if you will, or transfer that into the presentation in the other language.
Yes. Yeah.
But we, from the other side, unless, you know, we really have to be in tune with you as the performer to pick up on that. I mean, I'm in agreement with you as what you were saying before, that when you go into a venue where you're performing live, you can feel the energy of the audience. I mean, they want to be there. They've spent whatever money they've spent and time that they've allocated. And I would like to think that, because to me it's an event. I want to dress up. I want to be there in, if you will, proper attire. Not necessarily a tuxedo, but I want to dress almost like going to church.
Yes.
Because this person is, I want to show respect to this person.
Right.
And I want to receive from them and them to receive from me. I mean, there's an exchange going on.
Yeah, and vice versa. If you talk of stage fright, it gets just clear now to me. My stage fright before I go and perform is actually the consciousness. All these people came, some of them really far, to hear me because they know there will be some experience. And this is actually for me the foundation of all the stage fright that I just in this moment can open up and be this instrument and pray in my own way, let it happen. So these people really, I can, through me, deliver why they came, you know?
Yeah.
So the most, it's not like the applause or something or like the press. It's always nice to have nice press. But the most, the thing that makes me most happy is when you feel these people go out of the room and they are just in a different state of mind.
Yeah.
They are more happy. They are in a different state of consciousness. You
know? There's a great example of the Mozart effect.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even Mozart. It's just that experience.
Right.
You know, and you, Marcello, you are, I don't know if you're consciously trying to do that with whatever it is that you're composing, whether it's for a trailer or whether you're composing a 12-part aria or what have you.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to be said for the last segment of things that you've addressed here. You know, on a musical tone, I was very inspired when I was younger, when I started listening to soundtracks, and the emotion that it caused in me, and I wanted to do that with other people. When I saw a film that had a piece of music that haunted me so, that's what motivated me to do what I'm doing. Now, you mentioned the word language. You know, you're talking about language and what it is to sing in different languages. I've had the luxury to work with singers that don't use an actual language. For example, Lisa Gerrard, who's very well known for what she does. You know, she sang, she did all the vocals on the movie Gladiator. She creates her own language when she sings. You know, she finds phonetically what's appropriate to the note that she's singing, and she'll come up with these languages. And you know, and it was, you know, the reason why I'm here with Willa is because Willa and I have started working on some music together, and I wanted to use that approach with Willa, where, you know, I had seen Willa's performances where she was singing in Polish and in French and in German, and I thought, or in English, and I thought it'd be interesting to have her also sing in a language that people can address. Uh-huh. That, you know, a Polish person would hear it and he thinks something because it's in a Polish language. Right. Or, you know, or now she's singing in English, so people who listen to English, they're going to think something about this music because it's in English. Yeah. We wanted to create a piece of music that's really an international experience that no one really understands the words, but it can mean something individual to each individual.
But at the same time, as with art, beauty is in the ear of
exactly.
the beholder.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, if I'm singing a song that's in a language, and maybe that particular story doesn't resonate with a person, it might deprive them of having the experience.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so
I can tell you one language that I would have difficulty listening to because for my ear, it's so harsh, it's so hard and almost calculating, and maybe there's some historical stuff in the back of my head, and that's German. I have a real hard time even listening to people speaking in German, mm-hmm. because the difference between Japanese and Chinese, I'd rather listen to Japanese than Chinese because Chinese is that same hard cutting. And of course, again, that's also the exposure I've had, the little exposure I've had to that. I mean, for example.
I would advise you to go to China, spend a couple of months, and then go to Germany.
If I can get my brother to take me.
And then after 2-3 months of German, you would find people that speak German that you find soothing to your ear, and then you'd think about what you just said, and you'd be like, wow, it's all about exposure.
Exactly. And my wife, my present wife, actually lived in Germany for a number of years. Mm-hmm. With her ex-husband. He was in the military, and so she was over there for several years, and she loves it. And she understands a few, still remembers a few words. But I tell you what, the one image that comes to my mind is that one woman who is supposedly the television spokesperson for North Korea. And boy, she is so angry. I mean, it just, and the way that she speaks is just like she's throwing missiles at you.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, it's like, okay, take a Valium or something.
Oh, yeah.
Just calm down. It's okay. Life will go on. You'll be okay. This is fascinating. Can you tell me about, because we're about ready to go to break here, tell me a little bit, both of you, about this piece that we are going to listen to, okay, as we go into break. What this is that EP that you were talking about, Willa?
This piece is already out and finished. No,
so
we are talking about the piece that Marcello De Francisci produced with me, which was a real wonderful experience and a trip, a real good trip, you know. How shall I? The title of it is Promise to Forgiven.
No, it's Tolerance.
Tolerance, okay. Tolerance, yeah, right. Marcello says.
Well, I mean, you know. I met Will. I really liked her. I saw her perform, and I really liked her work. And I wanted to. I saw that she was very versatile in her talent, where she was able to address many different cultures. And my approach to working with Willa was to find, you know, not the international side of Willa, but her own unique voice, you know, without language, you know, who is Willa as an artist. And so I. You know, listening to her music and knowing her background, having lived in Germany and having had a classical background, I thought that it would be great to address what I feel is a real strong side of Willa, which is to address the classical side, yet making it contemporary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, and using a lot of techniques on a production end to bring her voice to sound really lush and beautiful and haunting.
So. More so than it already does.
More so than it already does. Yes, sir. Yes.
Wonderful. Absolutely. Tolerance will be the piece we're going to go out with here on the program. I'm Richard Dugan. We're in studio with Willa Weber and also with Marcello De Francisi. And we are, I can't tell you how excited I am about this. This is, you know, there are a lot of things that I have done in my career. I have recorded some, as I said, little musical groups who wanted to have a little cassette. And this was back in the 80s when cassettes were in the prime. So I'd have them come into my living room and I'd set up the three or four microphones and I'd try to do my best to isolate and balance them on the console, the control board and so forth. And then I'd, you know, run them off of from the reel to reel. I'd run off the master cassette, and then I'd run them off on a duplicator that I purchased, and it was such a unique experience. And then I started seeing the images of sound studios and these massive boards, okay, with 30, 40, 50 pots across, and all of the different effects, the pots going up. And at the time, not fully understanding what all of those were for, but now I do, and I'm going, wow, boy, they can really. And of course, now it's all computerized where you could, for example, if you wanted to have the same effect from the piece that she did back in 2012, okay, and you've got that programmed into the console, you just hit a button and boom, all those settings come up, and okay, we're going to have that same sound quality.
Amazing. Computers are really expanded in a way where, for example, on you know, I do tracks now. Those mixing boards had 48 tracks, 48 faders. On Willa's, the track that we've done titled Tolerance, if I were to condense, I mean, I condensed percussions, but that track, if I were to tell you every track I recorded, that track has over 250 tracks of audio, you know. So we'd need a mixing board that had 250 tracks. You know?
Well, and the other
thing that's available now through a computer.
Yeah. You know? And now, am I correct that when the recordings are done, all of the tracks of the various parts, they are still in their raw state in the computer. It's only the console that is set to have those effects, and then that output is set.
Exactly.
So you can always go back. That's what I love about what I do and when I do multitracks. And I tell people, so look, what we've got, that will be there forever. It will never change.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Now we're going to go to the multitrack session.
Well, you say it will never change, but then Apple or one of these computer companies will change their operating system, and in 5 years from now, you won't be able to open up the programs like it's happened to me. And there you go. Oh, my God. What do we do now? Yeah, we have the setting. We have the original thing. So I have to find a computer with an old operating system.
Somehow to do that.
And a piece of gear that existed during that time that has the same driver so that I can open up this session.
Well, we've discussed the possibility in this very building that you were sitting in of opening up our own museum, because we have a lot of old equipment.
Okay.
I have a lot of old equipment at home too. I have a real-time digital disc recorder.
Oh my God.
A rack mount. I have a DAT recorder.
Tascam.
Yeah. I have two
DAT machine.
Technique. I have a DAT machine. Two reel-to-reels, four-track reel-to-reels. One of them does accommodate, I think it does accommodate 10-inch reels. I have a turntable, both a real turntable with motor driven, and I also have a USB turntable that I bought 5 years ago, and it's still in the box.
That's funny.
And with that, we're going to go to Tolerance, and we'll be back. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I would like you to stay right where you are. Enjoy this piece of music, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. I'm extremely excited about our conversation here on the program. And as every program is the same in that, and I share this with you as I share with my listeners many, many times, I have no questions. The universe asks the questions. I'm just along for the ride. So I never know what's going to come up. I never know what direction we're going to go. I'm always open to bullet points from our guests. But at the same time, you know, each program takes on a life of its own. And then that, to me, is very exciting. I would like to talk a little bit more about the, shall we say, the spiritual aspects, both of performing as well as composing, especially the aspect of intuition. Mm-hmm. Now, I've asked this question, Marcello, of composers, of conductors. I've placed this pseudo-mathematical equation before them and said, how do you do that? You have a composer, such as yourself, who has written a piece that is to be performed in a particular way, and you can outline that in the score, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You then have a conductor who must read that score and conduct the orchestra to perform it the way you've intended. You then have your various musicians who are going to have their own take on that piece. Yes, they have the same score for their particular instrument. And I'm wondering about the level of, shall we say, accuracy. Are you there with the conductor while they're performing to make sure that it sounds the way you want it? Or is the conductor sufficiently informed through the score that what you, shall, I'm just going to use the term, intuited onto the paper, onto the score, is now on the CD or on the file or wherever it's captured, mm-hmm. or in the air to the audience, mm-hmm. so that that is what I envision. Yes, blue, green, and yellow. No, there's not supposed to be purple in there. So forth. So tell me about that process.
My process is one of the reasons I learned engineering in depth is because when you're working with a director, he comes in your room and you do what they call mock-ups. In other words, you do a simulation of what it would sound to go to orchestra. And a lot of times directors fall in love with these mock-ups because today we have access to some amazing, amazing libraries that have actually been recorded with real live orchestras. So I'm able to create a mock-up very much like an architect creates a mock-up of a house and says, this is what the house is going to look like. This is the architecture of this piece for this scene in this film. And so the reason why I got so deep into engineering was because if it so happens, usually there's a time crunch when you're working on a film. There's no time. Mm-hmm. And you go to orchestra and you have that one chance to get an orchestra to record that piece of music. So by knowing engineering, if that piece of music is not recorded exactly the way I want it, by knowing how to engineer it so that it does once I get it back and I can work with the audio to make it sound the way I want it, it still allows me to have the final say as opposed to leaving it to the hands of the musicians and the conductor.
Okay.
Now, if it's being played live for a live venue, then obviously it would be practiced and it would be performed before it happens. And so there, I would make all the necessary changes
in
so that
rehearsals,
when it is performed,
yeah.
it actually sounds the way I want it to.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. for some silly reason, I didn't even think of putting Willa in the category of the musicians. But Willa, you're the musician.
Yeah.
And you have the score in front of you, and you've got the conductor right there, and Marcello is sitting off to the side, glaring at you, saying, you better get this right.
But, you know, I mean,
no, my interpretation is this.
In her situation, yeah. we would have practiced it enough.
Right, right.
So that when she does
sure.
do that, you know, go ahead. Right.
Yes, I mean, we have both ways. Like that I get something from a genius composer like Marcello, and I can, you know, work with it and practice it and deliver it in a studio, of course, with emotion and my voice in the mm-hmm. best way. And there is the other path of working together, which is very intuitive. So Marcello is preparing a pattern, a track, thinking of my voice, of a vision he has, and I get on the mic mm-hmm. and I just for now improvise, you know, and do this thing with this language that just comes out now in the moment. And this is pure emotion. So we have both ways with somebody like Marcello. This is why I really love to work with him. I can do both ways.
So
it would be boring in the long run to just deliver like what is written in a score and then practice it, you know.
Okay.
No, this is like a very creative moment in the studio. And this is what I love about recording. You have these magic moments in performances, okay?
Yeah.
And it can be videotaped and audiotaped, but it will never be like this captured as it was. Now you're in a high-class studio. You have a magical moment. Something really happens. You're an instrument. Something comes through you, inspired through the track, inspired through the amazing percussion drums that are on a track like Marcello's. And then you have it. It will be there for many, many people to listen again.
Yeah. It's captured in
intimacy.
The intimacy of that moment, of that, you know, of the creative flow of two people in a studio where I let, you know, the way I like to work, I studied fine arts in Spain. And I look at the work that I do very much kind of like a painter. It's I get to sit with a singer, like I've done with Lisa Gerard, like I've done with many singers, with Bahar Shah, who's another singer I work with from Persian descent, like I did with Willa, in the sense that, you know, I start to create a tone and just let them create their broad strokes, you know, with their vocals, you know. It's almost like a impressionist painter that's just playing these beautiful broad strokes. And then they leave, and I get to go with all the equipment and start to fine-tune the vocals and fine-tune the beauty, those jewels that they lay down on the tracks, and go, okay, let's really turn it. And then they come back, you know. Then I bring them back. And it's a beautiful process. It's really, really nice process.
Look, this is exactly the key thing why I didn't leave my classical background, but this was like this key moment I had, like when you are a soprano, you get engaged and hired to sing Dvorak's Stabat Mater, Mozart Requiem, solo part. So you spend all this time on perfecting yourself and deliver something others have sang so often, and it's on CDs and it's delivered. So, and this was for me the reason why I wanted to spread my wings and open up the horizons. I went to New York, and this is why I like working with somebody like Marcello De Francisci is like much more, of course, exciting and much more in the creative zone, you know, than constantly delivering something others did already. And then the conductor tells you, oh, here, less vibrato in here like this. And you know, so that's different.
I tell you what flashed in my mind was my experiences right at the beginning of my career. I was thrown into producing radio theater. And we would record the actors first. The cast would come into studio, and the director was there with the script, and I was recording it, and he was directing them, and we'd get all the tracks down. And then he and I would spend the next several days in studio laying down whatever music he wanted and the sound effects and so forth.
That must have been fun for you.
I got to tell you, I was 21 years old.
Wow.
And we were producing the very first play I ever produced. And I started looking at it and saying, okay, don't be intimidated by the fact that it's a play. It's a long form commercial. Okay. You got a beginning, a middle, and an end, just like in a commercial. Mm-hmm. You've got music and sound effects, just like some commercials. And we had one of those moments. It brings tears to my eyes to this day. There is a scene where one of the actors is, and I actually suggested this. I says, I need you to deliver those lines, because the narrations, the scene set is that you're out there digging your wife's grave. This was a Norman Corwin play, the late Norman Corwin. And I need you to deliver the lines like you're digging in the dirt. And so that's what he did. He said, I'm digging a trench here to run off the water so that when the next time we then took, and back then they had the old IBM Selectric typewriters with the metal copy holder. And we took that and a Marantz cassette recorder and a microphone, and we went out to piles of dirt that were out there because there was still construction going on. Our studio was brand new. They just built it. It was one of those that was actually raised off the ground so the vibrations of cars going by wouldn't affect it. So we went out there. And again, we weren't listening to the track of the guy doing the acting. We just started. I says, we all have to be quiet, and I'm just going to dig in the dirt. We took it back in and we laid it down underneath.
So you were creating the Foley for this, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it lined up. We weren't trying to line it up. It just did. That's the kind of magic that we had in studio.
Yeah, it happens that way.
Oh, my God.
When I worked with Willow, we had some magical moments where sometimes, and what happens is you start recording and then you're done, you're tired, it's 1 a.m. and you go, I don't even know if any of this is good. And then, not that she wouldn't do great stuff, but you know, you're exhausted, you're overwhelmed, and then all of a sudden the next day is those aha moments where I'm alone and I go, oh my God, listen to this, and listen to this. Oh. And then she comes in a few days later and she's like, she doesn't even remember that she did all this beautiful work.
Yeah.
You know, that it all somehow, there's a moment when you do all this work that there's a moment where everything all of a sudden lines up and you find yourself in front of something that you go, I don't even know how I got here.
Well, I tell you.
So that's the spiritual aspect, I guess, if you were to say.
I think so. I used to produce, people would come to me at the religious station I worked for. They want to produce their programs, and they'd bring this pile of vinyl and cassettes and so forth. I said, have you timed any of this out? No. Which they usually didn't, you know. They didn't know how to do all of that stuff. So, okay, fine. And their program was 30 minutes. And so I said, all right, well, we'll start putting it together. And we just started, and I would get into that zone, and we just started putting it together. And I wasn't timing anything. I was just laying stuff into the recording. And by the time we were at the 30-minute mark, we'd basically taken care of all that they wanted to, and it all fit. And it would I would have that happen time and time and time again.
Well, that's a gift.
And
that's a divine gift, I guess. Yeah. You could call it that. You know?
I appreciate that. I'll take it. Now, with the computerized editing and so forth, the multitrack, I have a template I created probably 20 years ago, back when I first got the very first version of the sound editing software that I use. And it was in its infancy.
Do you mind telling me which software that was?
Cool Edit was the name of it originally. And it was actually created by a company that was in Scottsdale, Arizona, Centrillium. And they sold it to Adobe. It is now Adobe Audition. Now, I had a trade magazine. I was flipping through looking at all the different sound editing software that was out there. And I'd already had Cool Edit for a long, long time. But I just wanted to see what other companies, what other organizations were using. NBC, CBS. And I came to BBC. And I'm flipping through there, and there's BBC. And I recognized the screenshot, and I read the article. And well, heck, if Cool Edit Pro is good enough for the BBC, it's good enough for me. And I had been using it for 10 years already. So I created this template where I had all of my marks, my cue marks, in my template, my session template, at 10, 15, 30, 60. And I was producing one day for someone, and I showed them the Windows file window. And they noticed that the length of all of the files, as far as the size, was exactly the same. All of them, all 15 of them, were exactly the same size, the same number of kilobytes. They said, well, how did that happen? How did you do that? And so I showed them the multi-track session. I says, your commercial is supposed to be 60 seconds, right? That marker is at 60 seconds. It shouldn't be over, and it shouldn't be under. Everything is exact. And for example, I've worked for a number of automation stations. If you're running automation, you have to be precise.
Of course.
And so.
Well, if you're working on a film, I mean, you know, I get.
But
notes.
See, with a film, you have that freedom.
Well, I get notes. You start working on a film, and you know, and you get like 15 different versions of the cut in a month
or in two weeks. Yeah.
And so you get notes from the music editor telling you the discrepancy of the piece that you just wrote has to be cut exactly 2 seconds and 10 frames. You know, so can you do that?
Yeah.
In other words, and then they start sending all the, and that's where, you know, the work that we do today as composers with the tools that we have.
You do expansion, compression.
No. You'll actually cut the piece and you'll figure out how you have to rewrite the area so there's a transition. You know, so that, and then that ends up going to orchestra. Sometimes you do that 50, you know, on the movie Samsara, which has a scene, it's called the food chain scene. It's very famous. It's got 17 million hits in Vimeo, the scene for that film.
Yeah.
That version of that, Mark Magidson, who's a wonderful person, a good friend of mine, he was the producer, and he's the one who actually handled the music side of the film. I did 18 versions of that piece. Okay, 18 versions. And it had multiple, tons of live tracks of percussion. And he'd come in and go, can you cut this? Can you make... And so that's the beauty of the work that we're doing today. It's surgical, basically.
I remember when the computer first came in and I started using editing software, and I was thinking, man, this is going to make editing fast. It took longer.
You know why? Because people can make more changes now.
Exactly. And you can be, just as you said, more precise, more surgical, right?
Absolutely.
But I've fortunately been able to get to a phase where, for example, on the day of our conversation, I produced a demo that was 46 minutes long. They came in studio. They did their recording. Even while we were recording the next track, I'm editing the last track that they did and cleaning it up and so forth and moving things around. And I love the fact that I can do it real time. And then he told me about where I could find the piece of music, and I grabbed it. I was actually able to produce the demo for them within the 1 hour time slot that we had allocated for this demo. But we had to record 46 minutes in order to get there.
Yeah.
And so I have come up with ways of making my time more efficient and the process more efficient. And so that's the beautiful thing. Although there are times when I miss getting down on my knees in front of, we had a reel-to-reel that was mounted in a rack that pivoted. I miss kneeling before the reel-to-reel with a splicing block, China marker, and splicing tape. There are days I really do miss that.
Really, huh?
That was so much fun. And I knew a lot of guys, when they would splice, they'd throw it in the garbage. I laid it up on top of the amp just in case. I may need to put that back in there.
Yeah.
Or I was looking for an effect, and I would actually reverse it, and I would put it back in because I wanted to go backwards.
But that's the beauty. Oh. I mean, when I studied fine arts, I learned how to paint with oil, right? And I went to a school that was an old school, and these were the tools. You had your pigment, your oil, your...
Yeah.
Today, those tools are in technology. The more technology you know, the more freedom you have.
Yes, absolutely.
That's why I've learned how to do all these things. That's why I'm able to sit with Willa in a room and say, you know what, let's find the right tone for you. A tone that's specific to her voice that sounds amazing in the stereo field.
If you go back and listen to music that was on tape, where the vocalist laid down, for example, the Carpenters is probably the best example, where the pop group the Carpenters, the brother and sister. And all of the vocals were theirs, the harmonies, the melodies, etc., etc.
This track, Tolerance, all the vocals you hear, all the vocals, all the choirs, it's all Willa.
It's just, I mean, I think
we
back to
that. We have multiple Willas in that track.
That's very cool.
It's very...
We're cloning you.
It's really, really interesting. Like, working with Marcello is like, with his intuition, he found the way. It's like a reconnection for myself to my upbringing, to my teenage years and to my childhood, because I was very, very close into a monastery and these monks singing, and I was myself as a kid, my parents didn't know why, very pious, always going to church and growing up in this thing, and Marcello brought this, heard this in my voice and probably intuitively in my whole being, that this Gregorian direction, this is kind of something that I bring in. And so this is very, very special and unique to work with him because, it's like a circle that gets closed.
Well, like I said, you have to be a good psychologist to be a good artist.
I want to thank the both of you for making the trip up from LA to share this time with us. I would love to have the both of you back in studio. And I have to say, not to impose, but I would love to have an opportunity maybe one day to sit in studio with you as she's in the studio.
You're welcome
recording.
To come by anytime.
I would just,
anytime.
That would be so fabulous.
Oh, we'd love to have you.
Oh,
we
I
would
tell
love
you.
To have
you. And I also, normally I ask my guests, because they're on Skype or on the phone, if you're in the Santa Barbara area, please come on down and we do this thing in studio. We've done that. So I thank you. But I have three questions for each of you, and I'm going to bounce it back and forth.
Okay.
So one of you will have an opportunity to think about it while the other's answering. But I'll alternate. So I'm going to start with you, Marcello. Who is Marcello De Francisi?
Who is Marcello? Marcello De Francisi is a film composer who has traveled the world, experienced life, and is able to portray a very unique vision in the work that he does as a visual artist, as a composer, as an individual. I'm not just a composer or a painter. I'm a person that studies life in general, and part of that life is expressed through my work.
Who is Willa Weber?
Okay. Well, my German name is actually Wiltrud Weber. That's how I grew up. Willa Weber is easier to say here. Okay. I always had the feeling, like, from small on, that, you come with a certain vision and mission and gift on this planet. And I know I have a capacity to make people feel kind of uplifted and happy, and my channel is my voice and my singing. So Willa Weber is a singer who wants to share places she can go while she sings with other people and bring them there. Okay.
Willa, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, of course, reach more people, reach people worldwide, you know, and contribute to peace. Absolutely. Why do we have all these walls? Because the different cultures, the different countries, they don't know about the other culture. And I mean, if I could stop all religions, there's only one religion. We all have God in ourselves. And I can, you know, I experience this when I sing, and I want everybody who listens to it to feel it.
And Marcello, what is it that you want to or what you hope to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, I love the work that I do. Composing music for movies is something that I have a profound passion for. And I want to do it at the highest level possible, to have the highest level of exposure and the tools to be able to express what I do in the most grandest, most elegant, most international level. That's what I'm hoping to achieve, and through it help a lot of people, people in many different cultures.
Very good, Marcello. What is your life's purpose?
Exactly what I just said.
Okay, Willa, what is your life's purpose?
It's actually I mentioned it before. There's something I feel I have to fulfill here on this planet, you know.
I thank you both. This has been great, and I think we're gonna do some more work together. I'm very excited about having you two in the studio. This has been
fantastic. You for having us. Thank you very much for having us.
Again, with Willa Weber and Marcello De Francisi, and we are Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Folks, do it with music. Here on Tell Me Your Story, I'm Richard Dugan. Join us again next time, and until that time, love Talal.